Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
You know, yesterday we talked with our Sri Natarajan on today's Make or Break Day for Goldman, which held its second ever Investor Day. A lot of ground covered. We've got a report card on the bank's businesses, how they've done. And covering it all for us today and at Goldman Sachs headquarters in New York City is Bloomberg News Wall Street reporter Shanali Bosak. She joins us live from there via Zoom. Shanali, lots to talk about. Incredible reporting and interview, and we're going to get to that that you did in just a moment. Tell us, though, about the mood and tone of the meeting. And as the executives at Goldman spoke, including the CEO, David Solomon, kind of what were the reactions? How was kind of the feedback?
Listen, there were a lot of stress. There was a lot of questions leading up to a whirlwind day. If you take a look, I'm sitting here right now. For those of you who cannot see, I'm still in Goldman Sachs' kind of main lobby here. And it's kind of business as usual. But you had Goldman Sachs executives really pointing out this idea of a Goldman 2.0. I was very surprised to hear that from John Waldron, the president of Goldman Sachs, because there's a lot of questions about, is this a lot of the same, or is this a question of whether there's a new strategy being outlined for Goldman Sachs? So what is Goldman Sachs 2.0? It is that trading business, it is that investment bank, coupled with that asset management business that they're leaning into and shaping up to be a bigger revenue driver moving forward. And really, that consumer business, they're considering strategic alternatives for. That leaves a cloud over its head and a lot of questions about how they rejigger that business moving forward and whether it exists 5 years from now, frankly.
All right. Having said that, let's play then a little bit of your interview with John Waldron, president and CEO, COO, of Goldman Sachs, who talked about that consumer unit. Check it out, everybody.
In those consumer platforms, we have a plan to drive to profitability. We told our investors today we would drive to profitability in 2025. We likewise said that we will look at and explore and are exploring strategic alternatives to make sure that we understand all opportunities in front of us to unlock value in platform solutions.
All right, that is from Shanali's interview earlier with John Waldron, president and COO of Goldman Sachs. So all strategies, does that mean that they might sell it ultimately?
I mean, in banker speak, strategic alternatives could mean that, but there are a wide range of options that are here on the table. They said the consumer business would break even, and again, it's now known as Platform Solutions, by 2025. So, you know, a lot of questions ahead for that business, but then you have to kind of look to the future here as well and take a look at, remember, Goldman Sachs is one of the biggest asset managers in the world, Carol. So you're looking at a $2.5 trillion business there that could be a lot more like the likes of a Blackstone or a KKR as they build the alternatives business within that large asset manager. So a lot of things to kind of look out for at once when you think about Goldman Sachs.
Shanali, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about anything that surprised you being there on the ground. Did you hear any funny gasps in the room when anything happened? Bring us some color here.
Let's also talk about some of the questions that the management answered very, very upfront. I think that there was a lot of bluntness in the room here as well. Remember, they answer the questions as it regarded to morale and turnover. And really, the reality for Goldman Sachs is turnover is the lowest it's been in 5 years. And again, that's a big Wall Street story here because Goldman cut a lot of jobs, but they were able to preserve pay for a lot of their senior partners. So when we asked about whether senior partners were on board here, they were saying that really everyone is ready to execute. And that was the whole point of really today. I do want to kind of point out the historical significance of a day like today, because the whole point is Goldman being more transparent to investors. This is a bank that has been public for decades, yet has only had its second ever investor day. So kind of a humongous moment to hear the executives come forward and their array of investment bankers showing you how they are going to make a bank that is different from the bank of the past, with still more stable recurring revenue in the future, even without that consumer business.
Yeah, and
as
we know
as they had the plan for before.
And we know, Shanali, that Solomon said there was some clear success, but also some clear stumbles. I wonder if you can tell me about the reaction specifically to Solomon, because we've talked a lot this week about how things have gone for him at Goldman over the past year or so. Do you think that he was able to move the needle on morale and his own positioning amongst his firm?
You know, it's really interesting that you ask that, because David Solomon gave a 10-minute presentation at the beginning, and he took almost an hour worth of questions at the end, but there was a whole team of people, and the people were largely different than the people you saw at the investor day in 2020. And there were some interesting new names. Kim Posnett, for example, was the third speaker who spoke about a one Goldman Sachs. The idea here being that this is, you know, one company, even though there are different divisions here. And frankly, if you look across the divisions, you have people who have switched jobs in between the divisions to take on new roles. Investment bankers who've come consumer bankers, investment bankers who've come asset managers. And so it was interesting to see some of those new faces come to light and more of the new Goldman, if you will, come to the surface.
Shanali, the stock's down 3% today. And I know markets have been bouncing around here, and the stock is up about 3%. You know, how do we kind of put Goldman versus JP Morgan versus Morgan Stanley versus Citi? Like, I know they're not all the same,
but they are kind of, in the sense that now asset and wealth is the new game in town for all of these big banks. Citi is leaning into wealth. Morgan Stanley has been leaning into asset and wealth. JP Morgan into asset and wealth. And so they are looking a little more alike than they used to look, frankly. And it's only recently that asset and wealth have become more of, you know, more of the jewel in the room here. This is not a business that was often given higher multiples, but all of a sudden you turn around and three of the largest banks have three of the largest asset managers in the world.
Right.
And that begs the question, what will they do to compete in that business? Because it is competitive.
You know, Shanali, you know this, you cover Wall Street. You know, I've covered it, you know, coming off the financial crisis, it's a very different Wall Street from what it was. But Goldman has always been kind of like this shining light, right? It's where everybody who went and got an MBA, that's where they wanted to work. Is there something different about this Goldman, or is it just a case of the financial, you know, community in general, the big banks? It's just things are changing.
Well, I think the problem is, it's not that Goldman has changed, it's that it hasn't. And so when you look at Goldman, I mean, they're more Goldman than ever in that their investment bank, their trading desks are blowing through the roof. They've gained a ton of market share. They're just trying to show you that they can also do this other thing, which is asset and wealth management. And they could do that at scale to the point that it can be a recurring revenue business that will stabilize the ship, because those other businesses can be quite volatile.
That was really well said, Shanali, that it's a matter of what hasn't changed and not what has. I wonder if you can spend a minute talking with us about the investor deck. It's 118 pages. We've talked about some of the big headlines from today, but what do you think, Shanali, is going to be the biggest headline from that investor deck that's going to last through, you know, 6 months from now, through the end of this year?
You know, the reality is it took a long time to get sold on the consumer story when it came to Goldman's announcement of the consumer story in the first place. How long will it take for investors to latch on to the asset management story as well? The asset management deck has a lot of compelling reasons as to how much money is coming in to the fundraising pools at Goldman Sachs. We're talking about the Goldman Sachs calling card around the world. And so does that private capital fundraising cycle really, you know, again, this is a challenge cycle across the world for every firm. What does Goldman look like in the next 5 years? Do they look more like a KKR or Blackstone in that business?
Shanali,
and again, Goldman's asset manager, by the way, is bigger than Blackstone.
Which is really smart perspective, right? As we have this conversation. So David Solomon, is his job safe for now?
For now, yeah.
But what's everybody gonna, what's the timeline? And is it 6 months? Is it another year? I mean, they've actually asked for a couple more years, right, for the consumer side of the business.
They've given 2 years for the break even, but to be honest with you, Carol, nobody asked about succession. Not a single analyst asked about it.
Why
it
do you think that is?
You know, I don't know. The reality is when it comes down to it, I'll put it the way Mike Mayo put it. He failed a class. He didn't fail school. And so the consumer business, it hit some macro challenges as well. He said they made some missteps. The question is now what happens in the next couple of years, and does the pressure mount, knowing that there is a lot of pressure on the consumer business and a timeline to turn it around?
Well, great reporting as always, Shanali. Thank you so much. Great interview too. And I highly recommend everybody go to the Bloomberg or check out Bloomberg.com to listen to all of Shanali's interview with John Waldron, the president and COO of Goldman Sachs. All right, Shanali Basak there at Goldman headquarters. Goldman shares, we mentioned, down about 3%. They are up 3% for the year. So how does that compare with a JP Morgan? JP Morgan's up almost 7%. And if you look at the KBW Bank Index, which really looks, more broadly at the bank sector, it is up about 9% year to date, so it's definitely lagging the sector this year.
Absolutely, just such great reporting from Shanali on that. Really cool.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Shaq, Serena, A-Rod, Jay-Z, many from the finance elite, even a former president, man, they were all in on it. We're talking about SPACs, a special purpose acquisition company, but oh, have the times changed. For more on the SPAC fad and fade, you've got to check out this story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands later this week, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg News equities reporter, Bailey Lipschultz. He wrote it. He joins us along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, Joel Weber, and they are both in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. SPACs, Joel, we know not new, but they definitely were on a tear in the last, couple of years?
A couple years. There were some great moments there, It seemed like, this was maybe too good to be true, and then, maybe it was. What Bailey, who has just done an amazing job covering this space in general, revealed here was something that was a little bit more specific, which is, there were companies that went public off of the SPAC boom. And Bailey, what's happened since then?
They're going bankrupt very quickly, too. And we've seen a number of these going bankrupt in less than a year, which is something that is not seen in a traditional IPO or really is very foreign to pretty much anyone in the public markets.
So you're telling me there's a reason that the initial public offering process is hellish?
Well, and it's funny when you look back at this, an aspect of SPACs is that if you invest in it, you can redeem and take your cash back. And that's something that is really hitting a lot of these companies. When the redemption rate is north of 90%, a lot of these newly public companies probably operating in more speculative industries, years from generating cash flow, are actually getting a small fraction of the cash needed. So it, in some cases, it actually costs more money to be public than they are getting from the process.
Is there any example, though, of a SPAC that deserved to be a SPAC and did okay?
DraftKings is the first one. They brought back, they made the SPAC mainstream. They were trading at about 17 before they went public, shot up to 70 in that online betting boom when growth stocks were all the rage and Cathy Wood was talking about the future of sports betting, and shot up above $70. So we've seen them hanging.
They've actually, what's interesting? I was thinking about, maybe we need a little bit of a primer, remind everybody how SPACs work, because maybe there is a reason for IPO roadshows in terms of not perfect, but some of the information that comes out in that vetting process. Remind us how SPACs work.
So SPACs are a shell company. So the sponsors will basically corral up whatever investors they can to raise cash for a blank check. We call them blank check companies. So they buy in at $10. You get a unit. The units can be split into a share and a warrant at a future date. Then the sponsor goes out, finds a target company that they want to bring public, then buy a chunk of, deal gets struck. And then at a future date, the investors vote on the deal and have the opportunity then to swap their shares for their cash back.
So not so much vetting, right? Like as in the IPO process, or is there?
There is some vetting, but the issue is that for skeptics is that the target companies are presenting, laying out these projections, and they were kind of wheeling and dealing with these projections, at some point, you know, laying out 50, 100, 300 times revenue growth and laying out expectations for what the market would look like in 2040, right, which obviously companies going public through an IPO would never do.
Also worth mentioning that if you don't go public, right, what happens to that money?
It gets returned to investors. And if you're the sponsor, as one person put it, you spent about $8 million in 2 years of your life trying to find a company. And so the incentive for sponsors is to find something to get some kind of deal done so that they actually can make money on it.
Yeah.
Well, so tell us about, okay, so you talked about DraftKings. So talk
walk us through some of the ones that haven't worked out so well.
Yeah, exactly, because that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest example, most recent example is Starry. So Starry was this internet home startup company, struck a deal last March. It was going to raise up to $450 million. Well, then a few months later, they decided, you know what, we set this minimum number we would raise. Well, we're going to scratch that. We just want to be publicly listed. So more than 90% of investors opt to redeem the stock. They have a thing called a PIPE, so private investment in public equity, which gives them about $155 million. And just 11 months later, they're bankrupt because they're spending a lot of cash, they have debt loads, and they're not anywhere near turning a profit. And that's really been kind of the mark that we've been tracking and looking at some of the data I've compiled. We have almost 100 companies that went public via SPAC that don't have enough cash to match their spending habits for the next year.
It just reminds me so much of, we've been talking about all of these big tech companies and how they were able to focus a lot on growth in a zero interest rate environment. Are SPACs another example of that, of fad that comes out because interest rates are low?
Without a doubt. And for investors, if you're raising a SPAC and you're a sponsor, it's easy to get investors to give you money because they're guaranteed a return.
Yeah. So like, why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you do that? And that's one of the things when you look at the fact that more than 850 of these were raised over 2020 and 2021, it wasn't because there were almost 1,000 private companies ready to go public. It was because investors were easy. It was easy money to be made if you were a hedge fund or an institution to know that no matter what, you were getting this interest in any type of sweetener. And if you could ditch it onto a retail trader who wants to spend $12 or $18 for a $10 pile of money, all the better.
Okay, so what happens next?
We just see more and more bankruptcies. It's really kind of the
seriously,
trend.
Seriously.
That's the expectation. Again, almost 100 from my tabulations, almost 100 companies don't have enough cash to manage their spending habits for the next year. 73 are trading below a dollar, which means they could be booted from the NYSE, from the NASDAQ. So these issues are really culminating again in an environment where investors don't want risky companies. They want profits. They want profits now, and they can get a better return by buying T-bills.
Can I just ask you, is some of it, I mean, it could be that it's just a speculative bet to begin with, or some of it's just the valuation was just way overdone. I mean, are some of these businesses actually, they could have been okay if maybe, I don't know, a different route?
A prime example, we were just talking about Hims & Hers, the company that does direct-to-consumer things like Viagra, things like hair medicine. They went public via SPAC. They were one of the worst-performing D-SPACs about 6 months ago, and now they're trading back above the $10 mark. So some of these companies actually are going to work out and should work out and do deserve to be publicly traded. The main question is, did they go public too early? And that's what we're seeing with a lot of these. We've already seen a dozen companies really get taken out at what I would call fire sale prices. So they're getting bought for less than a dollar when they were valued at 10 times that. And that's a way that investors are able to recoup some losses, and these companies actually should be public.
We've seen this way before.
I mean, I can't wait. You know, the flying taxi companies are still out there, right? Let's talk about those next time.
Well, we had another one that recently went public that sells a more than $500,000 flying motorcycle company that de-SPAC'd.
All right. TBD.
That we got to talk about again.
Bailey. All right. To be continued, Bailey Lipschultz, equities reporter at Bloomberg News, Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, this story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit about shopping. What? Do you not like to do it?
I'm so excited. Oh, Carol, this is going to be my favorite segment of the day.
We're going to talk about Target. We still have more earnings to come. We got a little bit last week, but Target, which is up about 14% so far here in 2023, came out with their latest update. They talked about inventory. Stock, Maddie, is up about 2% in today's session.
Yeah, and it's just really interesting to monitor how Target does because it gives us such good insight into how consumers are doing. So we're going to get a deep dive on Target and retail, bringing in Jen Bartoshis, Senior Retail Staples and Packed Food Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence on the phone with us from New Jersey. Jen, thank you so much for making time for us. Let's start with the news of the day, Target. What was the single biggest takeaway for you on the news?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And looking at Target, it really was a story today about conservative guidance. And a conservative outlook for the year, but it really does seem justified. It's been a very, very turbulent time for retail, and Target has a greater exposure to discretionary spending than some of the other big stores that we watch, like Walmart or Costco. And so seeing them take a kind of cautious approach to the year is probably the right strategy for them. And they're going to couple that with, you know, cost control and some of the things that will help them keep the Target story going.
You know, Jen, I do think about inventory. It's something we talked about a lot with the retailers, I feel like, over the last year, that especially with, you know, troubled and strained supply chains, that people were stocking up big time to make sure that they had what customers wanted. And so then there was the work down of it. Is there something specific, though, to the Target story that is, you know, more problematic or different from what we've seen more broadly in retail?
Well, I would say last year they had huge problems with inventory. Mm-hmm. They had way too much inventory and all of the wrong things. They managed to clear that out pretty effectively. And I think what investors were worried about was that inventory level coming out of the holiday season. But the good news was that inventory for the discretionary categories was actually down 13%. So that really says to me that they did a very good job of kind of right-sizing their inventory in those categories where there's the greatest risk, especially for bigger markdowns and things that could hurt your margin. So it seems that their strategy to manage inventory actually really did do pretty well over the holiday season, and that was very good news coming out of their release today.
You know, I think about the lack of staples at Target because we were talking about Walmart and how they've mm-hmm. been able to, you know, keep a steady pace of customers coming through the door because they sell a lot of food. And so people come in for that and that helps them out. With Target, that's not necessarily the case. If we continue towards this recessionary environment, does that become a problem for Target?
Well, Target is I would say yes, it is something that Target will have to grapple with, because you most people don't do a full food shop at Target.
Yeah.
You know, they do have other high frequency categories like beauty that does pretty well. But if we go into a bigger recession or spending pulls back even further, it is harder for Target to navigate those waters than for a peer like Walmart. But you know, I will say that some of the strategies they have, which is to sort of double down on personalized offers and being more careful about how they do promotions, at least could help them preserve a little bit of margin if they have to go down that path.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the beauty piece? You mentioned they did really well in that. I'm curious how much of a factor that was in Target's success and what's making them such a stellar performer in that category.
Because they now have that collab, right, with Ulta Beauty,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, they do. And that collaboration has actually been very successful. It's been a little over 300 stores. And from what Target says and also from what Ulta says, it's been very incremental to them. So it's helped them with traffic, it's helped them with sales, but it's also kind of elevated Target as a beauty destination. But even the stores that have an Ulta in them, the beauty department is actually doing well. And I think part of that is that Target has done a good job of diversifying what they offer. So when you think about inclusivity and you think about different product needs that different types of consumers have, Target has done a very good job of tailoring their assortment and offering something interesting and new and fresh, and that's what's drawing people to that beauty department. And it is a pretty high-frequency category, so they keep coming back, and they explore what's new, and they buy their stand, you know, the products that they use all the time as well.
Hey, Jen, I'm assuming it's high margin too, right?
Exactly. It is a higher margin category than, say, food or paper products. And so that definitely helps Target as well.
So why do most people go to Target? I mean, I certainly went when my daughter was younger, right? Like, we would
go for
kids' clothes and things, and we'd go for, like, paper towels and stuff like that. And we used to joke that, like, you couldn't get out of Target for at least, you know, it was at least $100 and normally, like, $200 or $300. But what do people go for Target? Because there was a period when their designer collaborations were a big reason why people came in. That was years ago. Why do people shop there?
Well, I think people shop there still for that sense of discovery, and it's discovery at a very affordable price point. So Target has moved away. They still do designer collaborations, of course, but their own brands have taken on such personality that when they turn over their seasons and they have new items, people are drawn there for just the browsing and for the search for something new that they can afford. And so whether it's one shirt that they can add to their wardrobe or whether it's a beauty product, that sense of discovery is one of the reasons that we see such strong traffic into stores. And that's really what saved Target over the holiday season. They had very positive and strong traffic into their stores, and that really helped buoy their overall results.
I have to say, I'm always surprised, like bathing suits and things.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty amazing kind of the stuff that they have in there. And you think, okay, I'm never going to find anything. And you're like, oh my God, I do.
I feel
and
like
it's very affordable.
I walk in there. We all do this. You walk in for a face cream and you leave having spent $300.
Yeah.
I mean, you just said it, Carol.
Yeah, exactly.
Jen, I wonder if you can explain a little bit. You mentioned that, and I love the way you said that you're able to kind of overspend and get that dopamine hit of discovering something new because the products are at a kind of favorable price point.
I feel like you found Maddie's love language a little bit.
Yeah. So oh, yeah. I'm like, retail is my new dream beat. Can you explain anything that Target does within its stores that you know of to kind of increase that behavior of discoverability?
Well, if you've been in a Target store lately and you look at how they have things set up, they have categories next to each other that are very complementary. And so you have, for example, you have fashion, and then right in the middle of that you have accessories, right? So you have models that have not just a dress, but they have a purse and they have sunglasses and they have, you know, things, and those items are right there. So it's easy to kind of cross over into that. And then you look across the aisle and now you've got beauty and you can buy a lipstick to complement the outfit as well. So they're very clever at how they're putting their merchandising up for display in the store and putting the categories next to each other that sort of naturally feed into the shopper going from one to the next.
All right.
So some people go to the store and hit one department and leave.
Yeah.
But Target's very good at encouraging you to do the whole circle.
All right. So I got to ask you, what does what we got from Target tell us about the consumer more broadly? We've had some strong retail spending data, but what does it tell us? And what kind of consumer are we talking about?
Well, you know, I think that we're still seeing that that lower income consumer is still a little bit constrained. They're very focused on just the necessities. Your kind of middle income consumer, which is kind of more closer to Target's core consumer, still has a little bit of play for discretionary spending, but they're being very selective. And so that's where the merchandising has to be really on point, because people are still doing a little bit, but it has to be what they want. And the higher end consumer, what we're seeing is that they're starting to be a little bit more conscious of their spending, trading down on areas where they can save a little bit of money, but without affecting quality. So you see the trade down for things like in grocery, and things like that. So it's really a story of where on the income, you know, income scale the consumer is.
Right.
And how that then plays for each retailer's strengths and weaknesses.
All right, Maddie, you have to say it.
Well, we were talking about a new term, richcession, the mm-hmm. idea that the recession is going to be impacting higher income and even middle income people, doing exactly what you just gave us the evidence of, Jen, that they're going to be the ones cutting back on spending in those, you know, categories that are a little bit more discretionary, like a Target.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if you think about it, you know, people who have retirement savings and are seeing the savings, you know, sort of erode a little bit with market performance, are thinking more about the future and thinking more about how do I make that up. And they can do that more easily by influencing their current spending levels and pulling back in certain areas. And so I think that that may be part of that as well, where you're seeing that higher income consumer a little bit more concerned because they see the longer-term impact on their overall finances.
Always appreciate your analysis. Jen Bartosius, she's Senior Retail Staples and Packaged Food Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us on the phone from New Jersey. Right now, shares of Target, they are up about 2% in today's trading session. You can read more at Bloomberg.com. Stock is up just shy of 15% so far in 2023.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's STIEFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving,
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 8 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up this Tuesday when it comes to the trade, and also really wrap up the month of February. And as we do, of course, Charlie breaking down some of the standouts in the trade today. But we've got equities really a leg down, if you will, in the last hour or so. But as we heard from Creedy earlier, it's really about, once again, what's going on in the Treasury trade, watching that 10-year with a yield of 3.90, staying below that 4% mark, 2-year note with a yield of 4.788. So, got to talk a little bit about what's going on.
We got to talk about what's going on in the markets and the macro. And to do all of that, we are going to chat with Nadia Lovell, Senior U.S. Equity Strategist at UBS Global Wealth Management. And Nadia joins us on Zoom in New York City. Nadia, great to speak with you. A little bit earlier, we were talking about this idea of the rich session, that the economy is going to be felt the most by the middle income, higher income folks. It feels like every day we get one of these new buzz terms to describe our economy. What are you looking at right now, and what is the term that maybe feels the most prescient to you?
You know, I think that this economy right now is sort of in suspension. You know, that's also being somewhat propped up by consumer spending, and that's coming in with inflation. You know, the Fed still has quite a bit more work to do in order to get that inflation genie back in the bottle. And that has implication, as we all know, for the economy. We think that ultimately the Fed might have to force this economy to experience a period of subtrend growth in order to get inflation back into the bottle, because ultimately inflation will be destructive to the consumer if it does not come back in line with the Fed's target.
So Nadia, in some ways, you're almost kind of popping the inflation bubble, like just do it, like get it done. Could be harsh, could be not comfortable, and bring about that recession to some extent.
To some extent, but you know what? I think the Fed is still trying to discover like where that neutral rate is and where that level of sufficiently restrictive monetary policy is. You know, we're in uncharted event coming out of this pandemic. So as we approach that probable level of sufficiently restrictive policy, we do to think that the Fed is going to do so in 25 basis points step. So we are looking for an additional 25 basis points increase in the March meeting as well as the May meeting. But they might have to go again in June if, you know, the labor market does not cool and if inflation still remains elevated. I know that there's this debate now in the marketplace that if we could see that resumption of the 50 basis points cadence, but we don't think so. We think that we're going to see more a string of 25 basis points and a more normal return to sort of remember the days when, you know, air rate hikes moved in 25 basis points increment. So we think that will be the path of the Fed will take going forward.
And we've been talking a lot about the hot inflation data out of Europe, the ECB potentially going up to 4% on the peak rate. That's what markets at least are pricing in now for the first time. To what extent does that impact your thinking and how you are positioning moving forward?
You know, as we know, like inflation has been a global problem. We do think that, you know, there are probably more opportunities outside of the U.S. So we're looking at areas within Europe as well, particularly Germany. And we tie some of that to the reopening of China. We're also looking at opportunities within China. As China reopened, we think that the consumer has amassed a vast amount of excess savings during the pandemic and they're waiting to spend that. That also ties very neatly into our outlook for Brent oil as well. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we do favor the energy sector, because we think that Brent oil will get above $100 this year and towards $105 by the time we get to the end of the year, and that should be positive for the energy sector. So that's sort of how the global economy is informing our thinking.
Nadia, why wouldn't we all just be in cash? We've got a great story on the Bloomberg about how for the first time in more than two decades, Basically, cash is beating the 60-40 portfolio. And so that could be, you know, cash or cash-like. So it could be six-month U.S. Treasury bills. I mean, why as an investor, when we, you know, day in and day out, I think, you know, Maddie, with our TV colleagues, with our guests, we're saying, is it a recession? Is it a soft landing without a landing? Is it a, you know, what is it? Is it a rolling recession? There are questions to be had, and we know Fed policy is not an exact science. So why not just play it safe when what the Fed is doing, this aggressive tightening, has really upended the investing world, if you will, and cash makes sense. You can get a decent yield.
Yeah, Carol, don't disagree with you in terms of like having some exposure to cash. I wouldn't be in all cash because at the end of the day, you know, we do need to have a diversified portfolio. And over a long term, we do think that the equity market will have better returns than cash. But near term, it is also prudent to have some dry powder and have some exposure to cash and get that pickup in yield while you wait for a better opportunity in the equity market, which
but
we
how
think
long
will
do you
come
think,
later
but
this
how,
year.
So later this year, you think that's when equities kind of bottom out? Do you think we've bottomed out with the S&P at this point? We keep bumping up against the lows and holding in terms of that upward trend that we've seen certainly this year. Do you think we take out that level on the S&P? I think it was back in October, right, that we hit a low.
Yes, yes. You know, it's quite possible that the S&P could dip back under 3,600, particularly if the macro data starts to deteriorate. Remember, what we're waiting for to sort of officially call a recession is a crack in the labor market, but the labor market does remain strong. So it feels like the recession is delayed, but not off of the table. So even if we don't retest the below 3,600 low, we do think that the market will pull back and correct from here. We are looking by year end that the S&P get down to 3,800 for our year end price target. And that's because valuation, I mean, the valuation support isn't there. Valuation is quite elevated in the context of a higher interest rate environment. And the earnings outlook continues to deteriorate. We're looking for a contraction of about 5% in earnings growth this year. And we don't think that that's fully appreciated by the market yet.
We have time for one sentence on this, Nadia. If you could sum up your biggest fear right now when it comes to the macro headwinds, what would that be? What's keeping you up at night?
Inflation. That inflation continues to price to the upside and the Fed has to go to 6%.
Yeah.
That leads to a deeper recession.
Yeah, the Fed has certainly put that front and center. Nadia, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Nadia Lovell, she is Senior U.S. Equity Strategist at UBS Global Wealth Management, joining us via Zoom in New York City. I liked what she said about economy and suspension, that the economy is still propped up by so much. You know, and we can just see that. It plays out in the retail sales numbers.
Yeah, and then we got to go to 6%, which is so interesting given what Jess said earlier about her sources saying, you know, we'll be fine as long as we don't actually go to 6%.
Right. There's a point where, right, there's a level that starts to really kind of unwind and take out investors, certainly on the equity side of things.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more. So you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.